dreams. All of us have dreams and ambitions, and we all try to manage our affairs in a certain way that makes sense to us, that reflect our values and our needs. We all do that. And guess what's going to happen eventually? Because one thing I have learned about life, this is an uncertain world. That's one thing I know. Most of you have figured that out by now too. But I'm just stating the obvious. Just let's agree on the obvious. We live in an uncertain world, and your plans and my dreams and my ambitions and whatever else I have coming out of my mind, they are subject to change. They are subject to blockages, resistance, things. Exhibit A, okay? This is what happens. We live in an uncertain world. Now, this is a small one. Some of you are going to go on a trip this week or next month. Be prepared, depending on what your dreams and ambitions are, goals on that trip. Just be open that there may be some changes to that. Jimmy and Ro have been waiting a month to go back to Mountain Home, Idaho, and the roads, it's been snowing and cold, things have changed. So expect that. We live in an uncertain world, okay? It's true in our lives today, modern world, and it's true way back when, everywhere else in the world. And today we're going to look at some changes that happened in the Bible, in Jerusalem, in about the year 445 BC, okay? And we're going to go back in time. Right now, we're going to peek behind the scenes in the capital city of the Persian Empire. It was called Susa. And the king at the time, the emperor, was a fellow named Artaxerxes. And he was a strong fellow, and he was descended from a long line of very strong emperors and more to come. He has a cupbearer. Do you guys know what a cupbearer does? A cupbearer tastes the wine to make sure nobody's poisoning the king. So if he drinks the wine and falls over dead, the king says, somebody doesn't like me out there. I don't think I'll drink that wine. And they also had people who tasted the food too. And it wasn't because they enjoyed that job. It was that was their self-defense. I was like the canary in the mine shaft. If that canary quits singing and they bring him up, don't go down. So if your cupbearer falls over, note to self, don't drink the wine. He was a cupbearer for Artaxerxes. He was a trusted man. He's going to go through a couple of things. And my plan this morning, my plan is to just share one major idea, and that's this. As you plan, seek God's hand. That's it. If you can remember that in a couple of days, I'll be really happy and I will have figured that my plan was successful. As you plan, seek God's hand, because you are going to make plans today. We all make plans. We can't help it. You can't avoid making plans, managing your affairs, making decisions, overseeing something, looking at kids, whatever, grandkids, looking at your finances. You're going to make plans. But while you do that, okay, here's the difference. Most people are self-centered. Most people think about themselves first, including a guy named Haig Valenzuela. And if he doesn't seek God's hand, then I'm going to strictly make plans based on what I think is right and best for me. And I live in a world and a society with other people. And if I just do that, and if you just do that, and if you just do that, we live in a society that doesn't work, and God knows that. He knows what our society needs. He knows what you and I need to work and to be and living in harmony in society. It's just for the good of mankind that God is there to have you seek his hand as you make your plans. And also another reason for this. Unless you're constantly kind of reevaluating, thinking about your plans and just staying in touch with God about them as they change, are you equipped to deal with the disappointment and the sadness and the discouragement that comes from your plans not working out? I mean, you all have dreams and ambitions and hopes and aspirations for yourself, for your kids, for your family, for your health, and they don't always happen. And if it's just you making these plans with no input from God in your life, you are going to be facing some sadness all for yourself and with yourself. So a couple of good reasons, but we're going to get into this with Nehemiah. So if you have your Bibles with you, please turn to Nehemiah chapter 2. All right, we are going to get into two cycles of Nehemiah's planning. First one is, as you see on your bulletin, the prayer or the answered prayer, is that what it says? The prayer is answered, something like that? Okay, chapter 2, the answered prayer. What is the prayer? First of all, what is the prayer? To do that, we have to do a little background. Let's look up on chapter 1 of Nehemiah. We're going to start with an answered prayer, and I'm going to pray. Father God, I get nervous and scared, and I get all fumbly up here, so my plans go awry very often, and so I need help, and that doesn't mean everything is going to be perfect here this morning, but help me out and help folks to hear what's going on here this morning from your word, and may they dig in for themselves and see what you have for them. Thank you in Christ's name. All right, folks. Nehemiah, like I say, is a cupbearer. He's been in touch with the earlier people who have gone back to the land. Remember, 80 years ago, they started going back with Zerubbabel. He took 50,000 people about 15 years before we're dealing with this episode. Ezra took off with 5,000 people. And now Nehemiah's been hearing that things are looking pretty bad there in Jerusalem. Now, they dealt with the altar. They built the temple. They're trying to make work with society. But Nehemiah's talking to people, and they're saying, man, the place looks really bad over there. It looks like the Valenzuela's house. Well, you should have seen our house when we were kids. This was back in the day. My dad was in the Navy. He was gone most of the time. And there were 5 boys. Now, I don't know how Gilbert's place looked, but his dad was usually around. But I understand there were 5 Gleason boys, too. But there were 5 of us, and we were wild. And we destroyed that house inside and out in the yard. And nothing grew in that house but mold and dirt. And it was just amazing. The yards, we single-handedly, well, all 5 of us, it was a group effort. We destroyed that place. And I remember I had a really rich uncle. He came over once, an Armenian guy, kind of a wealthy Armenian businessman. What's wrong with you? Why don't you clean this place up, fix it up? And, you know, because he'd see broken windows, and he was a businessman, and this was just a completely different world. He could have been on Mars when he came to our place. And so Jerusalem sort of had this look. The walls, you know, when the Babylonians went into Jerusalem earlier, they just pounded the place. It was their idea to destroy this place so nobody would want to go back there again. Burn everything, break things down, destroy the walls, and that makes the city uninhabitable. Nobody wants to live there. So Nehemiah is hearing this, and it bothers him. It bothers him. So he prays in chapter 1. You could read about that later. But finally, in chapter 1, verse 11, the last verse, he says, O Lord, let your ear be attentive to the prayer of this your servant and to the prayer of your servants who delight in revering your name. Give your servant success today by granting him favor in the presence of this man, that is Artaxerxes. Straight to the top. God, let me get the attention of this emperor, because how else are we going to fix this thing? I know you got all the plans of the world. You could take care of it, but I'm here, and I got access to this guy, this emperor, this King Artaxerxes, so maybe can that work? Would that be okay? Or does that show lack of faith? Should we trust the government to do things for us, or should we do them ourselves? Well, in a way, he's asking God to help the governor, the emperor, help him. I mean, God uses different things. Okay, so this is what Nehemiah prayed. So the answer to the prayer comes 4 months later. How do I know 4 months? How do I know this took 4 months to get the answer? Yes, up above in verse 1 of chapter 1, month of Kislev, which is November, December. And now I'm in chapter 2 in the month of Nisan, so which is March, April. So it's 4 months, okay? So he's talking to Artaxerxes, and wine was brought in for him. I'm reading in verse 1, chapter 1. He took it to the wine to the king, and he was sad because, of course, he's dealing with this disappointment and depression of his homeland. And the king asked me, why does your face look so sad when you are not sick? This can be nothing but sadness of heart. And if you would allow me to say this, depression, sadness of heart, disappointment, grief, depression, just a melancholy spirit. That's how they would say it. I was afraid, but I said to the king, may the king live forever. Why should my face not look sad when the city where my fathers are buried lies in ruins and its gates have been destroyed by fire? The king said to me, what is it you want? Okay, so number one, his prayer before was answered. He prayed. Now he realizes, okay, my prayer's been answered. Now what do I do? Well, remember, my major thought was, as you plan, seek God's hand. Oh, okay, here it is. Nehemiah's up to bat. And the king asks him, what do you want? Now, is it okay to pray right now when you're serving the king? Absolutely. How long does it take to pray? 5 seconds, 10 seconds? Well, when you're going under, you say, oh, God, help me. It doesn't, I'm not, you know, sometimes that's all it takes. Whoa, God, oh, now. That's God knows your heart. He knows how you feel about stuff and what's important to you. So Nehemiah didn't have to pray long. It doesn't say what he prayed. It just says he prayed to the God of heaven. Didn't say what he prayed, how long he prayed. It doesn't say anything, but he prayed. So seek God's hand as you make your plan. So he's thinking now. But what he follows up with is evidence that he has been thinking about this for the previous at least 4 months, right? Because what he comes up with is a very detailed list. Let's read what he asks the king. Then I prayed to the king of heaven, to the God of heaven, and I asked the king, if it pleases the king, and if your servant has found favor in his sight, let him send me to the city of Judah where my fathers are buried so I can rebuild it. Then the king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked him, how long will your journey take and when will you get back? Because he trusted Nehemiah. See, kings had to be very careful back then who was watching over them, who was their immediate coterie of assistants, because that's not a secure position to be, believe it or not. Being an emperor, a king in those days was very scary for you and all your descendants, all your family. First thing they do is they go for you and anybody related to you. So he trusts Nehemiah. So he says, how long are you going to be back so I can expect you? And it pleased the king to send me, so I set a time. So he says, okay, I'll give you a time, and we'll find out more about that later. Then he said, I also said to him, if it pleases the king, may I have letters to the governors of Trans-Euphrates, that would be the west, you know, the Euphrates River kind of goes like this, and he wanted everything that was to the west of that river, basically Syria, Armenia. There was no Turkey at the time, it was Armenia, and it remains today, Armenia. That part of Jordan, Syria, that's the Trans-Euphrates, so that they will provide me with safe conduct until I arrive in Judah. And may I have a letter to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so he will give me timber to make beams for the gates of the citadel by the temple and for the city, a wall, and for the residence I shall occupy. And because the gracious hand of my God was upon me, the king granted my request. So the second part of his plan is you pray. Pray, then you prepare. And he's preparing now. He's laying out all the preparations. And because the gracious king, he granted, so the last thing you do is you proceed, right? You pray, seek God's hand, you prepare, you make your preparations, and you proceed. So verse 9, so I went to the governors of Trans-Euphrates and gave them the king's letters. Well, that seems kind of simple, isn't it? The king also sent army officers and cavalry with me. That seems simple, easy, bingo, bango, bongo. He's across the Cyclops, and he's lickety-brindle. He's going to the basket, and he's ready to put the first ball in the basket, and it's beautiful, right? Wrong. What was the other law of the universe? Inevitably, Murphy's Law. Okay, so here we go. Verse 10, when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official heard about this, they were very much disturbed that someone had come to promote the welfare of the Israelites. These are official people. And one thing about officials, no matter what, they like power. They don't like people taking any of their power, any of their resources. They were officials, and they heard about this, and they're disturbed that somebody's coming to maybe take some of the feathers out of their nest. What does somebody say? There was a rat in the storehouse. Well, these rats had a good supply of stuff, and now somebody else is coming in there, and their treasury is going to maybe have some competition for resources. Okay, let's go back over his preparations. Now, when you look at his preparations, they're very thorough. He is talking about official sanctioned letters. He's talking about government involvement. He's talking about a safe conduct pass. He wants protection. He wants transportation. He wants letters. He wants part of the official budget of the emperor to get wood, timber, okay? He wants to build. He wants building supplies for him, the temple, and his own place. He's looking after his own well-being here. And the king said yes. And he also had protection on the way, army officers and cavalry. Now, how much planning, here, let me ask you a question. Is planning like this, is this biblical? Is this kind of preparation biblical? Does it represent faith or not faith? Question. Let's go to Ezra chapter 8. I'm going to give you a second to get there. We're going to compare this plan of Nehemiah to Ezra's plan in chapter 8 of Ezra. Maybe one, two, three, or four pages south. Go back four or five pages in your Bible. Ezra chapter 8. Let's look at verse 22. Well, actually, 21. 8, 21. Ezra's ready to take 5,000 people with him. And as you heard last recently, about $4 million, as Gilbert described, how much gold and silver and stuff they're taking with him. About $4 million. But here's what Ezra says with the 5,000 people who are coming with them. There, by the Ahava Canal, I proclaimed a fast so that we might humble ourselves before our God and ask him for a safe journey for us and for our children with all our possessions. So he's leaving the same city as Nehemiah is planning to leave. This is 15 years earlier. Going with 5,000 people and $4 million worth of goods in coin, silver, valuable possessions. So here's what he says. Gets together for prayer and fasting time, and he says, I was ashamed to ask the king for soldiers and horsemen to protect us from enemies on the road, because we had told the king, the good hand of our God is on everyone who looks to him. But his great anger is against all who forsake him. So we fasted and petitioned our God about this, and he answered our prayer. He was ashamed to ask the king for protection. Nehemiah asked for safe conduct passes. He got soldiers and cavalry to accompany him. He got government funding. You know what? As I speak to as many people as I am today, there's going to be a division in how you see planning and the role of God and man in your plans. Some of you are going to favor Ezra. You're going to like the George Mueller approach. You're going to say, look, he never asked for funds. He just went out there and he felt God called him and God was going to take care of him with his family and his $4 million in jewels and gold and silver. And he's going to make a point not to ask for any help from anybody and trust God to get him there safely, because he wants God to get glory and God to get recognition that he's taking care of us. Some of you are going to feel that way. I know that. I know some guys who are very into that type of mindset. They really like it. Some of you are going to like Nehemiah's way of doing things. Let's lay this out. Let's plan it out. Let's write down what we need to do, what we need to accomplish. How much do we need? In what order do we have to have this? Are we going to have plenty of gas? What should we do? Where are we going to stop? As some of you might say, you're fretting, you're worrying too much, Nehemiah. And what if Nehemiah had written to Ezra, because he was in touch with the people in Judah, in Jerusalem. That's why he's kind of wanting to get there. So he knows what's going on there. And what if Ezra, hey, Ezra, I'm planning on coming over there. What do you think? What should I do? And Ezra, what do you think he would have told him? Trust God, Nehemiah, and come on over. But he didn't. We don't have any sense that he did. So Nehemiah prayed. He made his plans, and he saw God's hand, and this was the way he took it. Now, is this kind of planning? Which one is the biblical approach? Because I know if I was to ask for a show of hands, you'd favor one or the other. And you know what? Like the rabbi said on Fiddler of the Roof, Is he right or is he right? They both can't be right, can they? Yeah, they're right. Okay, guess what? I'm going to say it. They're both following God's plan for what God knows their heart. I'm going to read you something. Is planning like this biblical? Okay. Paul had to plan 3 trips on his missionary journey. Said he planned it. You know, back in the day, it was a rule that anybody, any male and the family who could make these trips to Jerusalem, when they were living there in the land, they had to go to Jerusalem 3 times for Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles. They had to make that trip. Now, that just doesn't happen without any planning. You just don't pick up and go 70, 80, 90 miles somewhere without planning. Well, the Jews had to do that. So they had to plan. They had to plan to do nothing on the Sabbath day, not lighting a candle, not fetching water, nothing. So they had to plan for the Sabbath day, have everything ready so you avoid work as soon as that little sun goes down and the Sabbath starts. You take it easy. Well, you got to plan. Did somebody forget to bring in the water? Oh, hey, Isaiah, you little bad boy, you didn't bring in the water. Now we're not going to drink water today because we can't, and it's going to be cold, and you didn't fetch the wood. Somebody has to plan all these things. Paul told the Corinthians in the New Testament how to plan to give money to the poor. He set aside, planned it. Paul took Luke with him on his trips. We read about that. Picked him up on the second trip, halfway through it. Wait a minute, Paul, why are you taking a doctor with you? What, you have the gift of healing. What in the world? You have no faith. You're taking a doctor. Why are you doing that, Paul? Just trust God. He's going to take care of you. And God did. You know, he got bit by a snake and he just prayed and it was okay. Pharaoh, I had this bad dream. We're going to be starving for this time. What do we do? Oh, Joseph, I have an idea. Let's put food away for these good years, and then we'll have them for the bad years. That's a good plan. Joseph went straight to the ranks. Proverbs 31. You know about Proverbs 31. The Proverbs 31 woman, what does she do? What is she known for? She makes excellent plans and provisions for the future. So it says, they smile at the future. Isn't that a beautiful picture? You can smile at the future and not stress over it because you've done your part in making the plans. A big part of Paul's second journey, among other things, was to raise money for the poor in Jerusalem. Well, let's just pray. Let's have a prayer meeting and pray for the poor in Jerusalem. Paul went to collect money for the poor in Jerusalem. Proverbs 21, verse 5, the plans of the diligent lead surely to abundance, but everyone who is hasty comes only to poverty. But Proverbs 3, 4, 5, you remember this one? Trust in the Lord with all your heart and lean not unto your own understanding. With all your heart, acknowledge him, and he will direct you. Right. So they're both true. Who's Ezra, Nehemiah? Yes, plans of the diligent lead to abundance. But trust the Lord with all your heart. Proverbs 16, verse 9, the heart of man plans his way, Nehemiah, Ezra, but the Lord establishes his steps. They're both true. And James, I think, probably pretty much kind of puts this all together. James chapter 4, verse 13. Now listen, you who say today or tomorrow we will go to this or that city, spend a year there, carry on business, and make money. Why, you do not even know, you don't even know what will happen tomorrow. What is your life? You are a mist that appears for a little while and then vanishes. Instead, you ought to say, if it is the Lord's will, we will live and do this or that. Both are true. Both are true. I think basically what we're talking about is an attitude of just humility, right? But you still got a plan. I mean, God actually chose the ant, for Pete's sake. He had to tell people to look at the ant and learn its ways. They're very diligent. They store up food, and every year they keep coming back. They survive. Somebody's. It's not the leprechauns making food for them. It's not them. They know how to do it, and so should we. We need to learn from others, even from ants. So what it comes down to is basically stewardship. Stewardship of your time, of your money, of your ideas. See, Scriptures clearly tell us that you are not your own. You were bought with a price, right? Because of Jesus' sacrifice, you've been bought, right? His sacrifice. So you're not your own, but I'm not going to feed you and take care of you and provide for you. You got to do that yourself. You're a steward of the life that God has loaned to you for a short while. You're just a mist. You're here for a short while. You're on loan. God has said, here's your life. I'm going to loan it to you. You are the steward. You need to manage it. You need to direct your affairs. You need to supervise and do a good job of this. You're a steward. He also says, it lists also in Corinthians that you are an ambassador, right? It says you're an ambassador. Well, there's all kinds of ambassadors. You could be a good ambassador or a lousy ambassador. You could be a good steward or a poor steward of the life you've been given. You will make decisions. There's no doubt about it. Like, see, they're wearing red and black together. Somebody woke up this morning and made all these decisions and all this thinking and stress said, yes, dear. And that's great. That's wonderful. He's a smart man. Look, I worked for the city of Gresham, and I had a position where it took a lot of details to get there. I know my pluses and minuses, and I'm not good with the details, but I would hire people to do that work of the details, because it is very, very important that things are there 5 days a week for the guys. They need trucks and equipment and concrete, and they need subcontractors ready to go, and they need the money, and they need to go be able to go rent tools and permission to go here. And that's too much, and I just wasn't good at it. But I know it needed to be done. There are details. And so you're a steward. You're a steward of your life. Yes, you are, believe it or not. God has loaned you your life for a short while for you to steward and manage well. So think about it. Stewards plan the affairs of others. They try and do a good job. So while you're planning, seek God's hand. Okay, so we have established that planning is biblical. And it's okay. There's not one right way to do this. Some people like to cross all their T's, but the main idea is here in the mind. Is there a humility and humbleness? Not that you're the great planner, all that and a bag of chips, but that you have a humility before God, that you are trying to do a good job. And number two, Murphy's Law is going to affect you no matter what you do. I think it was Dwight D. Eisenhower. He was quite a great leader and a planner, very thorough planner. He was the Supreme Allied Commander for Europe, so he was in charge of planning. Amazing, like D-Day. It took months to plan that out. He said, before the battle starts, plans are everything. Once the battle starts, plans are nothing. Get ready, because in this messy thing called war and life, plans are going to change, and you need to be ready for those changes. And sometimes, well, we're going to get to it next, on the next cycle. We're going to move ahead. So the first cycle was planning. And what part does God want you to play, and how should you look at planning? Is it biblical, and what role do you play in it? Responsibility, God's part in the planning, and prayer? Okay, so both. But you should be planning. You should be preparing. It's going to have to happen. Okay. Part two, the second cycle of Nehemiah's return. Let's read on, verse 13. I went to Jerusalem, and after staying there 3 days, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. So this is, I'm going to assume, would you allow me to say this is his prayer? He said, I had not told anyone what God had put in my heart to do for Jerusalem. So he's been praying. God, what do I do? What do I do? So he's been praying to God, show me, God, what to do. While I plan, I'm going to seek God's hand. And so Nehemiah, this man who prays regularly, a man who plans and prepares regularly. Read the book. You'll be surprised at this guy. Okay, so that was his prayer. God, show me what to do. I want to show this to people, but I need to know. So the preparation was, let's go and see. Let's go see these walls that I've heard were broken. I want to see for myself. Verse 13, by night I went out through the gate valley, through the jackal wall, unto the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. Then I moved toward the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through, so I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. Finally, I turned back and re-entered through the valley gate, and I apologize for speaking fastly, but I'm just going through the details. The officials did not know where I had gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or nobles or officials or any others who would be doing the work. So he's preparing his plan. Engineers call this site inspection, field work. It's the first step you have to do before you submit your plans. There's other things you got to do, maybe examine the soil, do some geotech, but you have to do this preparation. And Nehemiah is a smart guy. If he were around today, he'd have some sort of engineering firm. He'd be with our friend Mr. Boyer here, and he'd probably be a subcontractor, and he'd be in charge of something with Jim's company. I don't know, but he's a great planner. It's a guy you want to put in charge of what you're doing. He knows his business. Well-trained, a person who can stand before emperors, and the emperor can say, good job, I want you not to go build this, or whatever it is. But he's doing the site inspection. He's looking at things very thoroughly. He's considering, how many guys is it going to take? What are they going to need? How long? Supplies. Very, very thorough. And if you want to really get into it and get ready for next week, you can go and read chapters 3 and 4, because it gets to be very, very detailed. And when you read all that very detailed stuff, don't do this. Don't say, oh boy, there goes the Bible again with, and she begat this, and he begat him, and they begat. There's, it's so boring. Instead, think about it this way. Wow, this guy Nehemiah, this contractor, is looking at things so thoroughly, he's able to give detailed plans to these builders. And these are volunteers, by the way. When you read about what they were, some were bakers and some were priests, and some, you know, they were not builders. They need a lot of supervision. And have any of you had the blessing of taking volunteer labor or interns who want to come and work for you because they want to learn some experience? Oh man, I'm going to say do it, but just people want to learn how to apply their school book learning or whatever in a real setting. So they like to get jobs as interns or volunteers to see how does this really look in life. And basically, they need a lot of babysitting, a lot of time, and you have to give them and a lot of detailed direction and supervision. And Nehemiah did that for these people. They haven't built walls before. Some were priests. So he's coming up with really detailed plans. So instead, I want you to see the next chapters if you read them, and while the next person's up here later on in the weeks to come. It's going to be really detailed, and if you're like me, you're going to kind of zzz through that, because the fountain gate was prepared by Shalom, the son of Koz, the ruler of the district of Mizpah. He rebuilt it, roofing it over and putting its doors and bolts and bars in place. He also repaired the wall of the pool of Siloam by the king's garden, as far as the steps going down to the city of David. Beyond him, Nehemiah, son of Azbuk, ruler of his half district, made repairs up to a point opposite the tombs of David, as far as the artificial pool in the house. Very, very detailed. Bolts and nuts and bars, and when you're working around water, very specific things that are engaged with water and seepage, because you don't want the water to seep away, all the little fines of soil, because when it's small, it gets bigger, and pretty soon you got this big hole, and pretty soon everything goes collapse and people get hurt. Instead, be like Jim Boyer, pay attention to those small details, and say what he said. Told Haig, we're building this thing so when the wind blows, it's not going to fall down and take your house with it. And I'm so glad there are people like Jim who build for the ages. You know, it's really well done. And there are good mechanics like Jimmy, you know, who just, man, when he builds something, you ought to see the stuff he builds. It's beautiful. And he and Roll, they cover the boats. It's just good canvas, good material, good stuff. And that's the kind of stuff I look at and I respect. And so, as we get into the next chapters of Nehemiah, just respect the man for his level of detail. And if you were one of his volunteers, you would say, oh, I'm sure glad I'm working for that guy. That's my man, Nehemiah. Okay, so that's the preparations. So he prayed, he prepared, and then he tells them, verse 17, You see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins. Its gates have been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. Okay, I also told him about the gracious hand of God upon me and what the king had said to me. So he's meeting the guys, telling them the plan. It's all prepared. And now the people say, let us start building. So they began the good work. Woo! Perfect. It's coming together. The plan. Who was it? I love it when a plan comes together. The A team. I love it when a plan comes together. And what happens every time? If it seems too good to be true, it is. So what should we expect now in this beautiful plan that's coming together? What's next? What's the next inevitable plan of the universe? Murphy's plan, Murphy's law. Here we go. But, verse 19, but when Sanballat the Horonite, Tobiah the Ammonite official, and Geshem the Arab heard about this, they mocked and ridiculed us. What is this you are doing? You are rebelling against the king. And Nehemiah tries to explain, but now they're saying, oh, we're going to get political on you. I'm an official of this empire. You're in trouble. I'm going to write another letter. You recall what happened last time somebody wrote a letter? It was like a 12-year delay in the building plan because they got in trouble with the Board of Commissioners downtown, and they wrote a letter, and they sent out inspectors, and you're in violation, so bam, stop work order. That's discouraging. So we are in an uncertain world, and Nehemiah faced that. He's already dealt with it once, and he's going to face opposition with these guys again. But he continues to pray. See, the cycle just doesn't say pray, prepare, proceed. It doesn't end just like that. It's not a perfect thing. We live in an uncertain world, so anywhere along the line, as you pray or prepare or proceed, we face Murphy's Law. There is opposition, and whatever can go wrong probably will go wrong, and you're going to face the consequences of just the depression and the anger and the resentment and the whatever. You know, it just comes with you not being where you thought you'd be by this time, whether it's in your life or with your marriage or your family or your travels or the garden or whatever. Things just, if that's how it is. And if you somehow manage to avoid that realization this long in your life, I don't want to wreck it for you. You'll just find out for yourself. However, I also understand that many of you handle your obstacles very, very well with a certain amount of grace that speaks to me. And I'm encouraged by that. I've been aware of many of you here and else in my life who are dealing with setbacks in marriage situations, in kids, finances, health, jobs, you know, just some of their dreams and just, you know, where you think you'd get in life and it's not there. But because these people aren't completely just self-centered, their sadness and their disappointment isn't just all then self-centered either. They've been in touch with God. They've been allowing God to have input in their lives. And so when they face their opposition and their disappointments and defeats, they keep praying. They understand that there's something bigger out there because they understand that they are stewards of their lives. They're trying to do a good job what they have on loan, the affairs of someone else. They actually look at their life as belonging to somebody else. I'm in this borrowed body for a while, and I'm gone, and I try to remember that, and you should too. And so when my plans for this borrowed body in life aren't realized, it's hard. I get sad. Of course I do. I'm not happy about that. But I realize that there's another person involved, and he knows, and I'll keep asking for help. I'll keep asking for input from him. And so will you. And I'm encouraged by that. So as you plan, as I plan, let's see God's hand through this whole thing. Now, you're going to make some decisions this week, probably in the next 15, 20 minutes, the next hour. You're going to make decisions. You have to make decisions. You have to. It's inevitable. But as you plan, seek God's hand in those decisions. You'll be wise for doing that. We get to watch Nehemiah do it. How he did it may not be the way you will do it. How Ezra did it may not be the way you're going to do it. But we sang here. I'm going to read this these verses because we sang this just 15 minutes ago. Remember, you're a steward, right? And what you do with this borrowed life, your borrowed life, has ripples. They go out, all around you. Kids, neighbors, fellow workers. It's not just you. You're not the only one who's going to be the recipient and have these decisions you make affect you. It could be others. So let me read to you this, because we just sang this. After all our hopes and dreams have come and gone, and our children sift through all we've left behind, may the clues that they discover and the memories they uncover become the light that leads them onto the road we each must find. Yeah. So your life can act as an anchor, as a beacon to other people who see what you do, how you respond to your disappointments, your plans that don't happen, the blockages you face. How do you deal with that? Your kids see that. Your neighbors see that. Your spouses see that. You can't hide this. And you want that to be something they look at. They say, I think I can learn something from this person, like we learn from Nehemiah. As a steward of your life, remember, you're not your own. Some of you are going to face some interesting decisions this week. Some of you, your world's going to get shaken. Others, it's going to be another ho-hum week, and I'm happy. I love boring. Boring is very underrated. I love routine boring. Why else do you think I work a maintenance job for 33 years? Because I'm that kind of guy. I'm a routine, recurring kind of a person, and I don't like it when my world gets shaken. I don't like change. And so this message, really, I have to embrace it myself, probably more than a lot of you. So I understand what I'm saying, and I take it seriously, that as I plan, I need to see God's hand, because sure as I live here, it's an uncertain world, and Mr. Murphy's right out there, and something's going to happen to my plan. Something's going to happen to your plans this week, today, and your response is going to speak volumes to your character and what you do with that. So remember that. As you plan, seek God's hand this week. Read Nehemiah. Read other people. These Paul tells us that what is written is for our benefit. We can learn from these people. You can learn. God has given you your life. You're a steward. Consider greatly seeking his hand as you make your plans. Father God, we stop now. We close the book here, but we don't close you out. We can close a lot of doors, but we voluntarily and intentionally leave our minds and our doors to our hearts open to you because, well, it's just something that's not wise. You are the maker of life. You are the creator of our lives. So wouldn't it make sense if we allowed you entry into this complicated, messy thing we call our life and allow you to speak to us? We sang that song. Speak, O Lord, as we look at these words that have been passed on down to us. May we reflect your kindness, your gentleness, your love as we seek to love you and love our neighbor this week, especially as we deal with some of our broken plans that don't come true. May we not be disappointed like kids who don't get what they want for Christmas, but rather understand that you, the giver of our life, the totality of our life, have good things in store for us. Thank you now in Christ's name. Amen.